Have you ever felt that pang of disappointment when you couldn't add a ticket to your collection because it was digital? Or maybe you just lost it? Well, StubForge.com is here to change that. Imagine this: tickets that not only look but feel like the real deal. Because each ticket from StubForge is printed on the same quality stock that Ticketmaster uses and printed with genuine ticket printers. It's like holding a piece of the concert, the game, or the show right in your hands. But StubForge isn't just about replacing tickets. With the easy-to-use interactive designer, you can create custom tickets for anything, from concerts to sports games, pregnancy announcements, or parties. Why not make your invitations stand out with tickets that are as unique as your event? And if you're trying to complete a back catalogue of missing tickets, StubForge offers bulk discounts to make it both easy and affordable. With StubForge, you can once more give your loved ones physical tickets and see their eyes light up instantly at the best gift you can give. So whether you're looking to reignite your ticket collection, craft the perfect gift, or send the coolest invites, head over to StubForge.com. Start creating today and see how StubForge makes every ticket a story worth saving. Visit StubForge.com and start making tickets today.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Have you ever had that sinking feeling that people are going to figure out that you're faking it? In today's episode of the Bravery Academy, we're talking exactly about that. Imposter syndrome. I'm joined by Dr. Victoria Thompson, a resident psychologist on the podcast. And today we share our wisdom and insights on how you can reframe and tackle that little voice that keeps making you feel like you are not good enough. This is a great episode for anybody that's ever doubted themselves and want to take control of how they think and how they feel. Welcome back, Dr. Vic, to the Bravery Academy. I'm so glad you're back for season two and excited to talk to you today about all things imposter syndrome.
Well, thank you for having me back.
Yeah.
Season two, here we are.
Yeah, it's been a great season one. So loved all the feedback people have been giving about your first season and the episodes with that.
It's a great topic for imposter syndrome.
Yeah, it is a really good one. Coming on to do a podcast.
Yeah, they want me back for season two.
Wait, what? I know. I look back actually even at the first episodes we recorded and that kind of gut feeling of like, oh, this is like, why me? Is this going to be good enough? And I was the same. It's why it took this podcast, The Bravery Academy, so much longer to do. It was really a big thing for me to step into this place of like, well, you know, it's not like it's my true crime story anymore. This is me coming in and sharing a bit more about my wisdom and what I feel comfortable with and bringing good people together. And, you know, I've got no media background. This is not my like experience overall, and it's been really fascinating. As you step into it, you realize actually there's some stuff that's just about giving it a go and seeing how it evolves, and very much about the imposter syndrome. How are you feeling with being on the podcast over the last wee while?
Oh, I mean, I feel probably similarly to you. I think, you know, you always wonder whether you are going to do a good job, or whether you know enough, or whether you're going to be personable enough, or whether, you know, you might get me on a couple of episodes and be like, oh gosh, who is this? And so, I mean, it's real vulnerability, isn't it? Like you said, you have all these doubts, and yet you have to try best you can to go toward, rather than sometimes what we can do, which is of course succumb to them and move away. And that kind of takes us further away from maybe where we're trying to get, wherever that is.
Absolutely. So tell me, what is imposter syndrome?
Yeah, well, it seems to be an increasingly popular term in the social media, etc. But in general, imposter syndrome refers to usually people with some good level of success, but that they feel fraudulent about the achievements that they've made. Commonly, that can sound like things like, oh yeah, they gave me the job, but that's because, you know, there was no one else, or I got lucky, or I just had a good interview, but underneath it beliefs that eventually people are going to realize that you are useless and incompetent.
Even in my group coaching, just a few weeks ago, we had my women's group, and there was some really amazing women that have done such high success. One high level doctor, who she was like trying to share with the young 20-year-olds that are in the group there as well, going, I still feel like I'm faking it, and I'm with these group of people that have, you know, driven in such a high level way, and I don't know if I'm good enough still. So like, it's good to talk about, well, who's going to be vulnerable to that? Is it something that we can change? Is it a natural occurrence to feel this as well?
Yeah. I mean, what a powerful experience that she was able to share that, because sometimes that's really useful for people to see someone that they view as confident and successful to share their own version of imposter syndrome. And perhaps people will be surprised that you yourself experience that, because one perceives, you know, you've got these podcasts that you've done and had great success with them, and yet you carry around the doubt.
Absolutely. Like, everything always feels like a little bit of a stretch. And there's that little voice that comes in and goes, well, who are you to do this? And I've definitely had imposter syndrome creep in so many times in my life. And actually, it's been a slight driver for me, because if I don't do it good enough, and not a perfectionist by any means, but if I don't do it to a certain level of have to get to here, then there is this little fear of like, well, that could be failure, and that could be perceived as, you know, not being good enough at the core. And I remember it coming in straight away after I finished my physio degree, which was my first degree. And that was, I remember going out into the world and going like, I do not know how to fix people. This does not feel safe. I had 4 years in the school, and there was great feedback. I was, you know, I top of my class. There's some really cool success in that. And I was like, if I feel like this, I don't know how everybody else is feeling right now. And it drove me to go back into my master's very early. Like, I was like, I need to get some more education. I don't feel really at this level that I can be as beneficial to people. And I remember arguing that to get early acceptance into my master's. Like, I want to get to this next level, because that's where I should feel safe enough. And it's interesting at how I'm sure many people come into their careers starting off going, I actually don't know anything. I don't know. How did you feel when you first graduated?
Yeah, the same. Yeah, I mean, I'm a clinical psychologist, and for those that aren't familiar, it's quite a competitive program. And when I got accepted, I mean, the biggest imposter syndrome of all time, I think, that I've experienced, this idea of like, are they sure? I genuinely at times thought that they had sent my acceptance letter to the wrong person, you know, really felt, and there was really no evidence for why, you know, why I shouldn't. You know, I had good grades. I had worked really hard to get into the position where I could be accepted. But something inside me felt that, yeah, I was a total imposter. And I thought, well, it's 4 years of training, and I did my doctorate alongside that. So I thought, well, at the end of that, I should feel competent. And then I remember qualifying, and they gave me the doctor title, stepping into the workplace and being like, I'm such a fraud. People do not want to come and see me because I have no idea what I'm doing. But obviously I did. I did well, and I passed the course, and like you. And then there was no evidence that, you know, I was incompetent. But yes, it sat there really heavily for a while. Still does sometimes.
So how does it start? How does imposter syndrome start in the first place?
There's quite a lot of emerging research, which is something we can talk about maybe a bit later on, around where it comes from and sort of who's more vulnerable to it. But like anything with psychological difficulty, it usually comes from various things, you know, your environmental reasons, your genetics, cultural background. So some clear examples that had started to come through in the literature are things around parenting, what kind of messages you got as a child. And it's interesting, because it seems that there's not, as anything with parenting, there seems to be no right way.
Yeah.
No way to win there. So some people can develop a tendency to have imposter syndrome because they were sort of overestimated as a child.
Sorry. Well, no one underestimated me.
You're right. Well, the other one is underestimated.
So I know, there we go.
It's a little better for you. But yeah, this idea that, well, I'm getting told that I'm really good and I'm a really high achiever, and I sort of feel like my achievements aren't matching that. So this kind of discrepancy between reality and the messaging that I'm being told, which makes children sometimes feel like they can't trust what they're being told is correct. But on the other hand, if you underestimate the child, then they too can be vulnerable. So in essence, it's pretty hard to get it right there. Somewhere in the middle, as always, seems to be the best way to manage it. At the beginning of the understanding of the phenomena, which was sort of late 70s, it was really investigated looking mostly at women and high achieving women and how imposter syndrome can impact women in particular. However, over time, there does seem to be some evidence that actually, no matter what your gender is, you are vulnerable to imposter syndrome. But overall, it does seem to be the slight elevations in the experience for women. And in addition, elevations for people of color, Black people, Indigenous communities, trans people, our LGBTQIA community, that they are a little more vulnerable to experiencing imposter syndrome as well.
Is that around being accepted?
Yeah, I mean, actually, this seems to be where the literature is heading in terms of research for imposter syndrome, is around how it impacts people from minority groups. But the idea is that in the usual world, there's a sense of feeling imposter-like or inadequate because, you know, we live in a society that is designed for white men. And so entering most jobs, often they are dominated by white men. And so sitting outside of that, it can be quite a challenge for people because they already feel inadequate or different to those who hold most of the power. And so it can make people more vulnerable. There is some interesting research about how actually the topic of imposter syndrome applies to people in minority groups, whether they that's actually something that they experience in the same way as, let's say, white people, because in fact, for some, the experience is that they are always underestimated. And therefore, they don't necessarily, you know, in some cases, don't necessarily have the sense of being overestimated and people getting it wrong. And in fact, their experience is much more commonly to feel underestimated, which I think as that research progresses, it's quite fascinating literature to understand, the difference in experience and the concept of imposter syndrome as a whole there, and whether it is something that really does apply, or is it more a representation of, you know, unaccommodating workplaces.
That's a really good reflection, I think, on that, because that's a safety response, right? When it comes down to stress, to talk a lot about in the podcast. And if our internal language and dialogue is making us kind of keep us in that state of going, I don't know if I feel safe or good enough. That's the level of safety is good enough for this environment. And I think also when you're having at that point of having to prove yourself as well. So there's kind of that driver, because you don't feel at this level to be seen as equal to maybe a white male in that environment, to push myself, I have to work a little bit harder or be seen in a different way or behave a different way. It actually often means there's a different output for you as well. You've got either energy, time, you've got to work harder, play harder to be able to be at that certain level. I think that's what really, from my point of view, then comes into the body symptoms and the mind symptoms, whether it's fatigue or exhaustion or burnout. The connection I find for women is burnout. And it's a very, again, hot topic or similar to imposter syndrome. But when people understand the why, I think that's what gives people the direction to shift it. And again, just being aware of what maybe imposter syndrome looks like from a symptoms or thoughts. Like you said, it's around, you know, not feeling good enough and or doubting yourself, even though you've got kind of evidence for it. Is there any other signs or things that people can look for to understand if that's coming up for them?
Well, I mean, most of the time it does show up in self-doubt, the feeling of kind of worrying about being found out. But there are some behavioral things as well that people can do to try and tackle their imposter syndrome. For example, studying like crazy, or feeling like if you've gone to work one day and someone's raised something you have no idea about, that you know, you go home and you try and learn every single thing about it, or over prepare for a presentation. Or for some people, it means, you know, the fear of being found out means that they don't contribute to like team meetings and things in case they say the wrong thing. And of course, then they're rumbled as being fraudulent, often, you know, not putting yourself forward for things that require, you know, risk and vulnerability or perhaps reflection of your work performance, things like promotions or leadership roles.
So I'm hearing it's a lot in the professional environment, right? You're not feeling good enough. What about in relationships or our personal life?
Yeah, I was just thinking about this topic because it's not one that there is much around, to be quite honest, but it's out there. I mean, I was thinking about the term, you know, you're punching.
That
colloquial term. For those who aren't familiar, punching means that you're punching above your weight, right? So that you're dating or having sex with someone that is out of your league, too good for you. And so commonly kind of used in jest. But it is a real thing for people that there are some relationships where that feeling of dating someone who you feel is out of your league is so real. This idea that they have sort of chosen you out of pity, or they're too scared to leave you, or really commonly this idea that eventually they'll realize that actually you're not anything, you're not good enough, and they'll leave you. So really strong feelings of abandonment, fears of abandonment and rejection.
So again, comes down to that self-talk, but I really like the way that you've framed it there. It comes down to good enough every time. Am I good enough? Am I good enough for this person? Am I good enough for this workplace? Am I good enough for this friendship circle? Yeah. Am I good enough as a parent? It's like, I feel like that as a parent sometimes. I'm like, definitely feeling the imposter syndrome coming up there at the moment in lots of ways. So many of us feel all those areas that we're just not quite at that next level on. It's great to sort of stop and be like, it can come into everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And can lead to some really maladaptive behaviors, a lot of self-sabotage in relationships, you know, just ending it because you just feel like, well, they'll do it eventually, pushing that person away. And like you said, in friendship groups as well, feeling I'm not good enough or not cool enough. And so just withdrawing totally and making our worlds smaller and smaller the more that we buy into that belief system, that imposter syndrome.
I like that kind of pointing out the fact that we have choices around that. And it seems so simple. But when it comes to our behaviors, we can shift it to being a behavior that's going to serve us and instead of the maladaptive one. And I think that, again, is around watching and catching ourselves out and awareness around it. So hopefully you're listening to the episode are going to go, okay, well, maybe that's me in this area of my life. And what would I do differently to shift that behavior, which will then impact both my body and my mind and my relationships?
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Our lives were never the same after we learned our 21-year-old daughter, Kristen, was murdered by her ex-boyfriend. It's a parent's worst nightmare. How much did we really know about domestic violence back then? Clearly not enough. Now we know plenty. We know domestic violence, or DV, can happen to anyone. 1 in 3 women suffer physical violence at the hands of intimate partners during their lifetimes. 1 in 3. I'm Bill Mitchell, host of the When Dating Hurts podcast. And my interviews with DV counselors, law enforcement, and especially actual DV survivors give the pandemic of domestic violence the attention it deserves. The When Dating Hurts podcast. It's a series of lives being saved.
If you are going to look at imposter syndrome, is it linked in with mental health disorders?
Yeah, so it's not one on its own. It's not a diagnostic category in the DSM, which is the manual that we use in New Zealand, and it's not in the ICD either, which is the international one, well, International Classification of Diseases manual. So on its own, no, it doesn't exist as a diagnosable condition. However, it is a well-known psychological phenomenon, and sometimes that doesn't mean that it's a pathology per se. It does have links with other pathologies, increased rates of things like depression and anxiety, which one would expect, you know, struggling at work with the sense of not being, like you said, good enough, or in our relationships or friendships, we can understand why that might lead to increased experience or likelihood of depression or anxiety. Or is it a chicken and the egg? Like anything in psychology, right? What came first? Perhaps, you know, your experience of depression and anxiety predisposes you to experience imposter syndrome. So who knows?
I think that's a really good point. The key thing is you can figure out how to change the egg chicken cycle, right? Like break that cycle of figuring out what came first and go, I can change the behavior afterwards. And that awareness around it is the key thing. So you said there's that, the self-doubts that come in, there's the kind of just the not feeling good enough in different ways. And it can be work and relationships, can be friendships. Is there any other things that they should be looking out for that can be signs that they may be leaning towards this as a pattern?
Yeah. Sensitivity can be one. Sensitivity to things like feedback or constructive criticism, which we tend to get at work. And also being fearful of failure. I mean, we're all prone to failure. We must have failures in our lives. And if we're fearful of them, it doesn't provide us much opportunity to grow. I know that's a bit cheesy, but it's true, right? We do learn a lot from our failures. And so without being vulnerable to failures and exploring what's gone wrong, whether it's relationships, friendships, in the workplace, then we really do miss out on an opportunity there.
I just think that criticism piece is really interesting, isn't it? Because it's how we both give criticism and we take criticism. Mm. What if we can't take criticism well? Where does that sort of stem from?
Well, it could be a million things. I think, you know, everyone's context is so important for understanding why things have worked out the way that they have. You know, we're not blank canvases. We've all been children, and when we're kids, we do internalize and learn so much from those around us. And of course we do. That's the way that we learn about the world and ourselves. So really early experiences of our self-identity and how people perceive us is so formative. So if we're critical of ourselves, you know, it is sometimes worth reflecting on your story. You know, what has your relationship been like with yourself growing up? How did people perceive you? How did you engage with others at school? How were you treated? Did you feel like you didn't fit in, or were you bullied? You know, you had negative relationship. There's so many causative factors in becoming more critical of ourselves, and also some, you know, predisposing factors like our personality traits that we might have. You know, if we were sort of more perfectionistic or a little more neurotic, then we are more likely to engage in self-criticism than people who have different personality structures.
So if people stay in the space of staying in this imposter syndrome cycle, I guess, of that kind of inner language and talk through their life, is there times in their life where it would change or become less? What is it? Is there anything in the research around that?
Yeah, there's a little bit emerging around age, that as we get older, we have less experience of, or reduced experience of, imposter syndrome, which, to be honest, I think makes sense. I mean, in terms of you gain more experience, more evidence in your, you know, in your brain of your achievements and accomplishments and abilities to navigate through failure. And the research does suggest that you sort of start to care less about many things as you get older and you kind of mature. And I don't know, I feel like in many facets of people's lives that they see that things that used to feel really important to them in their sort of teen years or early 20s start to feel less and less important over time.
I think those life crisis moments for me are the ones that put things in perspective around that.
Right.
Like if I kept saying these things to myself, is this going to serve me or not? Obviously, my 20-year-old version to the 30-year-old to my now 40-year-old version of the things I say is very different. Mm. I think that plague of doubt is just, for so many of us, sits there, and we're starting to reframe it to begin to change the way that you look after yourself. And I've challenged a lot of people on this because they're like, oh, I don't want to go and talk to somebody. I don't want to go do this stuff. It's like, that just seems too scary. Mm. And it shouldn't be, because it's an awareness piece. How do we make it less scary for people?
I think, like you said, you just have to kind of face the reality of it, that this is something that I really struggle with. You know, I just have to own up to it and be like, gosh, this sounds like, you know, even when you're listening to this, this sounds like me in so many aspects of my life, and I can try and ignore it and carry on with some of the behaviors that maybe I do to self-soothe it, to calm it down, you know, my perfectionist behaviors or my avoidance behaviors. But ultimately, shining a light on it, on your own vulnerability there and being like, well, you know, I really struggle with this feeling of being inadequate, of being a fraud, of people finding out that I'm a fake, or that they'll realize, like you said, I'm not good enough. And that's our ultimate fear, isn't it? This deep-seated core belief that suddenly someone one day will realize that we're just not enough. And we try so hard in many aspects of our life to just make ourselves feel enough, whether it's trying to earn more money or keep our house clean or dress a certain way, to just feel enough. So if we just sit with it and accept it as our reality that we feel like that, that's really helpful. Because then, okay, well, knowing that, what do I want to do with it? Like you said, is this helpful to me? Do I want to spend my 40s, my 50s feeling like this?
Probably one of the tools that changed it for me was self-compassion versus like looking at self-esteem. You know, this is the thing what we measure ourselves on. The 20-year-old self should have been saying, well, of course you're not going to know it all. You're only just come out of university. You're a Bambi. Look at your legs wobbling. You know, you're still learning. And that's okay. Look at all the other Bambis around that don't know what they're doing and still trying to navigate it. And part of it is the curiosity and shifting that place of going, I'm going to learn as I go. And I think that, that if I had that reframing now and that some self-compassion tools, oh, it just shifts when that voice comes up now for me in a big way. And men and women that I work with too, I can see them go, oh yeah, I'm not the only person that feels like that. So that common humanity element, like you said, when you hear somebody else say that or you hear us saying this, you're not alone.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I have these sort of visceral memories of being in my first year of practice as a psychologist and people asking me questions. In particular, I found it difficult when parents would ask me questions, because I think, you know, one, because, you know, I was fairly young when you finish your doctorate and felt perhaps like a little kid, you know, the sort of parent-child dynamic, but also, you know, a big sense of responsibility for their child. And of course, and when they'd ask me a question, I'd be like, oh my God, I have no idea. I really don't know the answer. And I remember sort of the first way I'd try and approach it was by bullshitting as best I could, or trying to kind of give a sort of roundabout answer. And then I'd go home and I would spend hours researching and reading all the research on these concepts. And look, all in all, it's not a terrible thing because it's a great learning for me. And I now, you know, I know about those topics or those concepts. But over time, I think you start to realize that actually, look, I don't know everything. You know, you could well ask me a question today and I will have no idea. But it's such a vulnerability to sit there and be like, oh, I don't know that answer, because I feel like if I do that, then people are going to think I'm useless.
I feel like that in so many ways, particularly post having kids and then hormonal changes in my brain. Sometimes I'm like, things aren't as fast as they used to be. And so it's allowing yourself to be like, I actually don't have the answers for that. Can you give me a moment, or I'm going to come back to you?
Yeah, which is totally fine. I think actually totally that restores confidence from people, where you can be like, well, actually, I am not familiar. I don't know the research in that area. I'll take some time to look at it. And hey, let me catch up with you about it next week. And then you really have time to sit back and consider it in relation to the case or the patient that you're working with. And all in all, it's a much more positive experience than the sort of panicked response. Yeah. And that just elicits so much pain and doubt. So much of the, like, afterwards, like, oh, see, Victoria, you know, you don't know anything that you're talking about. This really catastrophic mindset that can appear.
Listening into that part of you that kind of comes in, and I've done a lot of personal stuff on that as well, but going, oh, well, she's a bit mean to me today, isn't she? Coming in there and like literally beating you up when you haven't even done something that warrants it. So it's been able to learn to speak to the part of you that's actually really worried about you not being good enough. Yeah. And I've found that actually that voice is often there to try and protect you, but she's not doing it in a very good way for me.
No.
And so I've got to learn to speak to it, to shift it around. And it can feel really woo-woo and weird to say. It's like I've learned to listen into these parts of me that drive me. And I know that they've been there to try and protect me in the past for success, because if I didn't, in my family, success was seen as degrees and achievements and or particularly being a fifth or sixth kids, you just said you had to do something to get sort of seen. Mm-hmm.
To find your identity. Yeah.
Yeah. Just to find your way and be a little bit different among the crowd. And that's great. There's lots of greatness around that. But actually, it still meant that I had to let that go eventually to be like, I don't have to keep striving anymore. I don't have to keep being seen. I don't have to know my why. And the voice can quiet a little bit because I've done enough.
Yeah.
This is actually enough right now. When it makes you go, is it good enough? I'm like, it's enough. And that's often a simple phrase I need to say to that part that kind of comes in. I'm like, it's enough. No more today.
Sometimes we can feel like we always need to be doing more, earning more, working harder, seeing people more often, buying a better car or whatever it is. When do you just lean into the idea of like, well, this is enough. I'm happy enough. But there's no end goal where this full sort of sense of accomplishment and happiness exists. So we're always going to feel inadequate in some way because we've got those deep-rooted belief systems that have existed in us for a long, long time. But yeah, I think it's a really powerful thing just to lean in and be mindful and lock into the present. Be like, do you know what? At this time, this is enough. This is totally enough for me. And it's not perfect. And my relationship isn't perfect. My house isn't perfect. But, you know, I'm happy enough.
I found that particularly in the last few weeks with having family staying and figuring out, you know, what are the things that I'm juggling as a mother and working and business and coaching and stuff. And you guess you can't give everything to everybody unless you put the little wee things around, this is what I need. And I think my experience from that has been, unless I speak my needs in a kind way, I'm going to be the one that burns out, gets overwhelmed because I'm trying to do it's not enough stage. Mm. So actually by going, it's enough for now, but what I need to do to make me feel like I'm okay is A, B, and C, then I have some action plans to kind of then make myself feel in a calmer, regulated way. If we learn to regulate that part of us that keeps coming in, then we take a bit of power back. And imposter syndrome feels like it's a pattern that can be shifted is what I'm hearing from you.
Yeah, but it takes a lot of work, like anything. Sorry. But, you know, psychological change does take work and it takes reflection and it takes, you know, repeated challenging of the thoughts that we have or the behaviors that we do and casting a light on them. And that can be really tough. And it's helpful sometimes to seek external support in cases where your imposter syndrome is really getting in the way of you having a functioning relationship or it's holding you back at work. Absolutely. There's also other things that one can do. At the beginning, you talked about the doctor that shared so much and this idea of community and connection, especially for, you know, more marginalized groups, finding other people who sit in the same or similar spaces to you and finding out what their experience is. Because, gosh, I remember when I was doing my clinical training and we used to have sort of group supervision to check in on one another. I remember having those conversations about, gosh, I just feel like I have no idea what I'm doing. And it's just so hard, you know, coming home at the end of the day and just feeling so unskilled. And in reality, well, I was training. I was relatively unskilled at that point. I was a Bambi, as you said. And that's okay. It's okay that I can struggle with things and find them hard. With the end goal being about developing my knowledge and my career, and that I'm never going to come to a point where I know everything. And I should hope I don't, because that means something's gone very wrong. And actually not knowing everything and not being overconfident at times is really a safe place to sit, particularly, I guess, in healthcare, right?
I think so. But I also think in leadership. So what I see with people when they can sit back from something and not have to know all the answers, you give space for others to step in. Mm. And that's where the beauty of it, like leadership isn't dominating and it's an action of listening. And so when I say, hey, I'm not really sure, what do you think? What would you suggest? It gives space in the workplace for others to step in. Or this is my thoughts. You know, it just gives people a little bit of a bandwidth and it can change that conversation around having to be the person that holds all the weight on the shoulders. You know, we're carrying the world and you can put it down. And that's one of the biggest things around that stress response is if we think that we have to be everything to everybody. And so I think creating courageous conversations around, do I feel good enough in these areas? And how do we support somebody feeling good enough? Doesn't mean you like have to be their cheerleaders all the time, but how do people express it in the first place as a partner? that can be a lovely way of, you know, helping build deeper connection and relationships and support people going, I actually am okay in this. This is my good enough right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, connection is such a nice way to develop your own self-awareness, to hear other people's stories and to reflect on how that links or is different from your own. Absolutely. And especially in leadership roles, you know, creating a safe space where you can name it and talk about it, especially for people starting out in their careers, to just label that as research suggests that 82% of people are going to experience imposter syndrome. So just, you know, if you're in a leadership role, just naming it or people coming into that space. I mean, we were much more likely to experience it in times where, you know, like for me and you, when we came out of postgraduate, that was a really vulnerable time for us where we were much more likely to experience imposter syndrome. But also starting a new job, my gosh, it's such an intense feeling. Well, for some, I'm not saying for everyone.
I don't know, intense.
But a huge feeling of imposter syndrome because you don't know everything and you worry about whether you ever will be able to do the job and whether they've employed the right person.
I think my biggest takeaways or things that I want to share with people as well is when you feel that visceral response you talked about earlier of like, oh, this doesn't feel good, I'm not sure. It's like that's when you can notice that you can put a different behavior into place. And if you do that, you can then start to break that cycle of how it might impact you overall, whether it's your sleep, whether it's your communication or your eating choices or your choices around alcohol. Just notice, take a little step to notice and see what you can do to shift that response. And it might be from the head, the heart, or the body. And those small things do add up. So like you said, we don't expect anybody to suddenly change these characteristics, psychological characteristics, in a week or in a window. It's going to take a bit of time putting into practice to see if this is going to stick and test ourselves out through times of challenge.
What I come back to with imposter syndrome is this idea of it's just a thought. Right? It's just a construct. Some people don't experience it. And so there's something about, you know, your story, your context that makes you just more vulnerable for that thought to pop up. Perhaps it is like we've talked about that you have this sort of deep-seated core belief of not being good enough. And that makes you much more vulnerable to experience thoughts of being a fraud or being found out or being rumbled. And so always pull back to is, well, thoughts are just thoughts. And we have so many a day. I mean, think about how many thoughts you have. And some of them are factual. Some of them, a small amount. Others are sort of bizarre or funny or inappropriate. You know, we have so many. We believe every single one of them. We're going to be in all types of different directions. And so remembering that, hey, well, yeah, I have the thought and I notice it and I'm noticing behavior, like you said, you know, I cast a light on it, but it doesn't mean I have to do anything with it. Just because I have the thought doesn't make it true. And that's something that you can apply to many, many different things in, you know, with this psychological distress is, well, just because I think it doesn't make it so.
Mm-hmm. Love that. Thoughts are just thoughts. Thank you for tuning into the Bravery Academy. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button. And if you're looking to take your support for the podcast to the next level, visit patreon.com/thebraveryacademy to access exclusive content and get early access to our upcoming episodes. Your feedback means the world to us. So please take a moment to give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for being part of the Bravery Academy community. Stay brave, stay curious, and keep challenging yourself to grow. Until next time.
Hi there. I'm Heather Drago.
And I'm Sarah Saunders.
We host the podcast, That's a Hard No, about saying no and setting boundaries.
So you can become that true and empowered you that this world needs. Saying no isn't just okay.
It's the key to living an authentic, fulfilling life.
I'm a licensed professional clinical counselor, so while this podcast is in no way a replacement for one-on-one therapy, I suppose I know what I'm talking about.
I'd say so. We talk about learning to say no and set healthy boundaries and how it impacts mental health, physical health, relationships, parenthood, and more.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit our website, hardnopodcast.com. no.com.
We're here to help you find your no and say it unapologetically.
That's a hard no.